Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with the North Carolina State Health Director, Dr. Jeffrey Engel, about public health emergencies. And boy, this is an important topic really for everyone in the state of North Carolina and for listeners outside North Carolina who recognize that a state health department is really the linchpin of how we approach public health in the United States.
Absolutely. And the first thing we're going to do before we get to that is have some research that matters and also talk about low back pain for our Weekend Warrior segment.
Yeah, it'll be good to have Dr. Ronnie Laney back on our show today. But first, Christy, like you said, research that matters. We got two studies today about coffee and tea and brain cancer and that popular joint supplement, glucosamine, and does it really work? Let's talk about our very first one about coffee and tea.
Well, coffee lovers, and I'm one of them, might be interested in knowing that there's some more evidence suggesting that coffee and tea might have a possible benefit to your life.
Yeah, this was actually an interesting study in the American Journal of, I think, Clinical Nutrition of 500,000 European adults. That's a large number from any study, looking at the risk of glioma, which is a very common, though, type of brain tumor in terms of the types of brain tumors, but overall brain tumors are not that common overall, and how that type of brain tumor relates to whether or not they had higher or lower coffee and tea.
So, yep, these gliomas are uncommon, but we did find that they're among people who drink more coffee and tea, that they had a lower risk of having this certain type of brain cancer called glioma.
Yeah, over 500,000 men and women who had, and then they kept these detailed histories about what they ate and drank and exercise. And really, after 10 years of follow-up, the risk of glioma from those who had 3 to 4 ounces of coffee or tea a day were significantly less than those who didn't drink any.
It's true, but one of the things they didn't find was what we call a dose-response relationship, meaning that if you drink more coffee and tea, that the more you drank, the less likely you were to have this kind of brain
cancer.
Right,
there should have been a benefit. If you're drinking one cup would be not as good as two cups, wouldn't be as good as three cups. So the more you drink, the better you would be. They didn't find that.
Right, and when we do find those sorts of dose-response relationships that we're talking about, that's more convincing that it makes a difference, whereas in this, there's an association, and it may have benefit, but certainly we need to look at this further.
Right. So all you coffee drinkers out there, another reason to maybe continue. However, as with everything, seems like more research is needed. But the next article, though, really is about something a lot of people do who have arthritis, which is they take this supplement, glucosamine and chondroitin. And the evidence in the past about whether it works has not been great. What does this study show, Christy?
This is a study of almost 4,000 patients with knee or hip osteoarthritis. And it was done by Swiss researchers. And they found, looking at this group of patients, that there was no clinically relevant effect, meaning really no benefit of taking either chondroitin or glucosamine or both of them together.
Yeah, you know, this was published in the British Medical Journal, a very prestigious journal, and looking at the fact that these supplements are actually being sold for almost $2 billion in 2008. And combining all of the different trials, if there was a major impact, it probably shows up when you combine all these different trials. So even if there is a positive impact, it's probably very, very, very small. And there's a large placebo effect. If I tell you you're going to get better, you have a greater chance of getting better. If you take a pill, you sometimes feel better. There's probably a strong placebo effect here with arthritis.
It's true. And so people may be paying for these out of pocket, and it may not be making a difference. And health insurers are unlikely to pay for this after this evidence showing they don't make a difference.
Yeah, and we should say that there are side effects of some of these supplements. So for glucosamine, for instance, it can thin the blood out. And so for some of our patients who are already on an aspirin, or maybe some patients are on Coumadin, or for some reason people are taking vitamin E or garlic, things that also thin your blood out, you're taking this, your blood's pretty thin, and you might actually have more risk for taking it than not taking it.
It's true. We do have evidence that weight loss can make a difference. And there was a new study, Adam, that I'd like for us to do on the show soon about the benefits of losing 9% of your weight loss on knee pain from osteoarthritis.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Christy. And speaking of looking forward to, we're actually really glad to have back with us today in Research That Matters are one of our weekend warriors, Dr. Ronnie Laney, one of our colleagues at the UNC Department of Family Medicine, talking about something really common in research that we know about low back pain, which, boy, I've had a lot of problems myself with over the years. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Laney.
Thanks, Adam and Christy.
Hey, Dr. Laney, what kind of crazy story do you have for us today?
Well, low back pain is a very common presenting symptom to clinics a lot. Interestingly enough, I saw a patient this week. Luckily, he wasn't harmed. So my patient was a 48-year-old male who was up on his house roof last week cleaning out his gutters. So you can see where this is going.
Yeah, and I don't like it already because I fell off my roof the last time I was on a ladder, and I'll never do it again.
Ooh.
Don't tell me that's what happened to him.
He didn't fall off the ladder. He was using a ladder, but lo and behold, the ladder did fall. And so he had to get down eventually. So what did he do? Well, he decides to just jump. So he jumps from his rooftop. It wasn't very high, but he did land safely. He was immediately unharmed, but he did present to the clinic 3 days later with complaining of low back pain and trouble walking upright.
Well, there's kind of these easy things that happen to a lot of people. I was playing golf yesterday, and someone just bent over to tie their shoe, and all of a sudden they stood up, and they said, they felt this twinge in their back. So this sounds like you can hurt your back fairly easily with sudden movement sometimes. Is that the case?
Very true. A lot of times, in fact, most of the time, it can be a muscle sprain or a strain in the ligamentous parts of the back. So acute back pain is what we're going to discuss today. And there are not too many causes of acute back pain. So the one thing I was worried about with him jumping was an axial load on the spine to result in some sort of fracture, which would be very uncommon, but she didn't have.
Well, that's really good. This is one of the most common presenting symptoms to primary care doctors across the nation. So you're saying you want to rule out that someone broke their back, but then what are the things we think about and that we advise patients to do?
And so some of the things you think about is a fracture. Some other more causes of acute back pain would be something called facet syndrome, where there's these two plates of the spine that rub against each other. They can that's more of an acute presentation, but also sacroiliac joint. There's a joint, your pelvis is actually made up of three different bones, and so there's a joint in the back that that can be disrupted in acute settings.
So all of these things can get inflamed or swell when you have acute trauma. And I know when I was coming through medical school, there was this dogma that said, everyone should go to bed for 48 hours and then all of a sudden things seem to change. I don't think that's what we tell people necessarily anymore.
Very true, Adam. In fact, a lot of things that have changed, we used to tell people stay off and rest for, as you said, 48 hours to even a week sometimes and take lots and lots of anti-inflammatories. We now know that in most musculoskeletal cases now, we actually encourage quicker return to activity. And actually, there's controversy surrounding the use of anti-inflammatories in all musculoskeletal injuries now because we know that the inflammatory process is actually needed in healing.
So we tell people to take anti-inflammatories like Motrin or Advil, and we tell people to move and not lay around in bed?
That's correct.
What else?
But wait a second. But you're saying that now we're not even saying there's controversy about having people take Advil. Right? Is that right?
That is true, but it also depends on the mechanism of injury and the actual injury. But for now, we're staying with the advice is to take the anti-inflammatories, and mostly for symptom relief right now.
But for the pain, but not necessarily for the swelling response, because there may be some healing that's when I went to see my orthopedist for a shoulder injury. That's what he told me.
That's correct. That's correct, Adam.
Interesting.
And so move your body, take the anti-inflammatories. Any other advice for people with acute back pain?
Most of it will actually get better on its own. In fact, most symptoms resolve within 30 days. And sometimes, though, we will refer people to physical therapy, and exercising and stretching those muscles out will help relieve the symptoms and return you to better healing.
Fantastic.
Well, that's great. Well, that's a wonderful Dr. Ronnie Laney, our weekend warrior, one of our weekend warriors here with us today. That probably wraps up what we can do about Research That Matters, but we've been able to talk about low back pain. Thank you.
And we've talked a little bit about joint supplements for arthritis and about coffee and a possible benefit to reduce a certain type of risk of brain cancer.
Well, that'll conclude Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with the director of the North Carolina State Health Department, Dr. Jeffrey Engel, about public health emergencies. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about public health and public health emergencies. And both Adam and I have backgrounds in public health, and certainly as family physicians, we care about the issues that affect broad health of the people of North Carolina. So we're talking not just about caring about our one-on-one relationships with our patients, but caring about issues that affect all of the people of North Carolina.
Yeah, and I think we're really fortunate today to have one of the state's leading experts and people whose job it is to think about this on a day-to-day basis and how to improve the people's health of the state of North Carolina. We'd like to welcome Dr. Jeffrey Engel to Your Health. Dr. Engel is the state health director leading the Division of Public Health in the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. He leads an agency of approximately 2,000 people that provides state-level administration and expertise in women's and children's health, epidemiology, and being prepared for disasters, chronic disease, injury prevention, oral health, health disparities. I mean, it's a huge undertaking. I think Christy and I marvel at the breadth and depth that is needed for this sort of job. Dr. Engel received his undergraduate and medical degrees from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, followed by residency and fellowship training at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Engel.
Adam, thank you. Christy, thank you.
Dr. Engel, Adam and I love to start out hearing a little more about your story, to see if you'd share with our listeners what got you passionate about public health and led you to this position.
Well, thanks. That's a great question. And I have a different background because I did not grow up in the public health realm in the traditional sense of getting my MD followed by a master's in public health degree and rising through the ranks in that infrastructure. I grew in the clinical world and trained in adult medicine and infectious disease and got my first job after all that training at ECU School of Medicine in Greenville, North Carolina, where I was immediately faced with the usual infectious disease problems of the day in 1988, which were HIV and AIDS and hospital-acquired infections. Those were and continue to be the bread and butter of infectious disease practice. So doing that for several years, you realize that all of that, almost all of it, is preventable. And that got me interested into epidemiology. I had taken classes earlier in my fellowship training in population health, in epidemiology, statistics, those basic core approaches. And then over time, I became the first medical director of hospital infection control at Pitt County Memorial Hospital, where I put together a program that began to look at preventing a lot of the nosocomial or healthcare-associated infections. That led to the state epidemiologist position in state government after serving for 14 years at ECU School of Medicine. And after the state epi position, I was promoted to state health director 18 months ago, and here I am now.
Wow.
Well, we're really glad that you're here in this position in North Carolina at this time and day, because there are so many issues that are affecting our state's public health. Maybe we could just start out, though, saying, you know, we're all clinicians here, and we're talking about the role of clinical medicine that I think all our listeners really understand well. When you come see the doctor, that's the thousands of practitioners across the state, primary care and specialists. When we talk about the state public health system, help us understand, what are the core functions in a parallel system that is looking after people's health in a much broader fashion?
Right. So in the clinic, you're advocating and taking care of that patient, that person right across from you at the bedside or in the clinic, sitting there in the chair with you, and you're talking. And you really want to do everything you can for that individual's health, whether it's heart disease or, in my case, infectious disease problems. In the population health, though, you're looking at the population, whether it be at the county or, in my case, it's the whole state. And historically, what core public health has done is eliminated a lot of the threats to that population that were transmitted person to person or could be prevented by sanitation, for example. So in the 20th century, we saw basically the elimination of many infectious diseases, including smallpox and polio, from vaccination. That is still core public health.
So clean water and immunizations to prevent disease.
Safe water, safe food. Those are our core functions, and that's what happens every day at the local, state, and federal level.
So we take for granted, perhaps, at least I know I do, the quality of the food and the water I drink. Yet I know from the what's been happening around the country recently that at least one of those has not been taken for granted. There's been a lot of questions about food safety. Help me understand, where's the interface between the work that the State Health Department is doing that might get involved in assuring that the safety of the food that we eat, buy, go out to eat at, where does that come into play?
Right. Well, there's a lot of emerging issues in contamination of food. A lot of them have to do to better surveillance, though. I've got to say right off the bat.
Surveillance meaning our ability to pick up a disease,
yes,
and figure out what caused it.
Right. So these things might have been going under the radar for years. But now with advanced laboratory and molecular methods, we're able to trace things back and detect outbreaks that are happening nationwide in maybe little clusters that we were never able to connect before, mainly with some genetic fingerprinting techniques of bacteria like Salmonella or E. coli.
So if there was an outbreak at a restaurant, for say, or in a region, you would be able to find out about that early and let people know, or maybe make it safer at that particular location?
Well, restaurant outbreaks are easier to detect at the local level because you get the calls coming in immediately to the local health department, and lots of people are sick, and it's clustered tight in time and space, and it's pretty much quickly taken care of. I'm talking about more of these national outbreaks that involve large food distribution chains, very complex, like the peanut butter outbreak with Salmonella, or the E. coli and spinach outbreak.
You know, here's some track where it went, where it came from, all the different places it could go, and how that affects our state.
Exactly. So our capacity at the state is really to get those sick people in, get them reported from that clinic to the public health, usually through our local health departments, and then test it at the state lab.
We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Engel, the state director leading the Division of Public Health in North Carolina. Dr. Engel, let's talk about a little bit about immunizations. You know, people think that all these diseases are under control, yet they're under control at some respect because the state health departments around the country have done such a good job of educating the public and helping ensure that these things are under control, but they're not under control. I know we have the pertussis and cases of pertussis and measles. How is the work that you're doing and that the people you supervise, what happens there when you're having these emerging or reemerging issues like measles and pertussis?
Right. Well, the measles issue has almost been eradicated in the United States. The pockets that we see are in unimmunized populations, usually people with religious exemptions or groups with religious exemptions, or in imported cases from folks who are overseas. But nevertheless, it's a huge problem. So when we have one case of measles, there's a huge ring of investigations that have to go on to find out if those who are exposed, are they protected or are they immunized? And this can take a huge amount of effort. Pertussis never was eliminated. That's whooping cough. And we have outbreaks all the time. That disease is spread by coughing like a common cold. The immunization is not 100% effective. Measles, and if you get two booster shots of measles, it's about 95% effective, whereas that's not the case with pertussis. It's more like 85%. So we have that issue. We have a droplet respiratory spread. We have infants who aren't immune until they've had their fourth or fifth booster shot. So there are a lot of factors that keep leading to that. And the groups that have religious exemptions still are contributing, and those who are unimmunized who arrive in this country from other countries.
Very challenging things to tackle.
Yes, all the time.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Engel, the North Carolina State Health Director. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Engel, the North Carolina State Health Director, the Division of Public Health, about public health emergencies. And really, our discussion has really focused on some of the core functions that public health has traditionally done. And we've only begun to really scratch the surface of some of those around immunizations, safe food, clean water. But it also is clear to me that the demands on our state health system have changed to reflect the changing nature of what clinicians are now dealing with, which is a lot of chronic disease. Tell us a little bit about how and when that change occurred, and what are the major issues that the state health department is really dealing with in chronic disease as well.
Right. I think what happens, probably over the last two or three decades, there's been an expanded role of your traditional public health agency, which is local, state, and federal. And now, instead of that core public health that we talked about earlier, we're looking at this broader umbrella called population health, which has to do with how healthy a population of people is, whether at the county level or even your community who lives in your block, who goes to your school, your workplace. How healthy are they? And over the 20th century, because of immunizations and other major advances in sanitation, infectious disease, sickness, and death became quite unusual. And other problems began to rise. And now the leading causes of death are no longer infection. In fact, that's usually number six or seven on the list, like pneumonia, HIV, AIDS. Now it's heart disease, stroke, cancer. And what we're looking at, similar to infectious diseases, these issues are also preventable.
So what kind of programs do you and the state health department help do on issues like tobacco, obesity, stroke?
Right. So if you look at the proximal causes of cancer and cardiovascular disease in adults, the number one real cause or root cause is cigarette smoke or tobacco smoking. So most lung cancers are due to that. Heart disease, lung disease are due to smoking. So if you can get at that proximal cause of getting people who smoke to quit, we know that we can impact health even though you've had a long history of smoking. If you stop today, we know we can change the course of your health quitting.
When you're thinking about that on the for the population level, how do you decide whether you focus on getting more people to quit or whether you change policy or how you approach it from smoking cessation counseling to broader things like higher taxes on cigarettes?
We do it all, Christy. We put in every intervention or every evidence-based strategy that we know works as long as we have adequate funding to do it. And some of these things don't take a lot of funding. So we talked about adults or older kids who smoke and getting them to stop. And also the other big one is getting youth never to start to begin with. Relating to that is a cost-free intervention called a tobacco tax. And we know that when you raise the price of the cost of a pack of cigarettes, children do not begin the habit. And that's been shown over and over and over again. I would say New York City and California are probably the best examples of that kind of policy, where a pack of cigarettes in New York City now costs, I don't know, $12, $13.
Wow.
In North Carolina, what is it, about $5 or $6 a pack?
And if
certainly this being able to take the step back, say, let's apply the evidence that works to essentially reduce broad, large populations of people, in this case, not to smoke or to encourage them to quit, and then to work with the policymakers to educate them and help them hopefully come to some decisions. What about in the issue of obesity? huge issue that everyone's concerned about. What are the kinds of roles that the state health department plays in trying to reverse what is really a crisis for our state and every state, really, right, in the country?
Yeah, so obesity, the rising tide now is 1 in 5 children are at risk or already obese. Type 2 diabetes in children, something we never saw. Now, this is a much more difficult societal problem to manage, whereas smoking is a voluntary habit. Everyone has to eat. So there you have a fundamental difference right away.
And with children, they don't have as much choice as perhaps adults.
Right. Right. So we're focusing on the same thing. As one is preventing that young person from ever getting in that shape. But the second approach is once they are in that shape, seeing if we can reverse the trend. And that has to do with nutrition and physical activity. Where public health can really have a major impact in both of these arenas in children is in the schools and in daycares before that. So we're already looking at policy changes regarding what foods are offered in daycare. Including getting rid of trans fats, going from whole milk to skim milk. I mean, these are very simple interventions that can have a huge impact on kids' lives. And then getting into school, reintroducing physical education back again, like when I was a child, I had PE every day. That's not done anymore. So these are just a couple of interventions that you can begin to take at the policy level.
So you guys are clearly forming partnerships with the school systems. You're forming partnerships with providers. You're forming partnerships with policymakers. And it seems like, you know, you might be behind a lot of different interventions simultaneously to try to address this issue.
That's correct. And that's the only way we're going to get it done. Public health here now, our traditional role is now expanded to that population, as I said at the onset of this part of the interview. And this, our success is really going to be getting everyone to own this problem: business community, the school community, families, individuals, faith-based community, because public health is not going to be able to solve it themselves. We can educate people. We can show people the data. We can get those partnerships, Adam, that you mentioned together and lead the discussion and the plan and the intervention. But it's got to be a total community effort.
And as we look at the next 5 or 10 years in our state, what are the next challenges? I mean, you've got enough work to do, but what do you foresee as really the next challenges on the horizon?
Right. If you live down in Louisiana, we know what we'd be talking about right now. We'd be talking about oil and disaster and those kinds of issues, but maybe you are dealing with those kinds of issues.
Right. Well, good question. In the next 5 to 10 years, in that population health realm, I'm going to be looking at those three proximal causes of sickness and death in North Carolinians, which is tobacco smoke and physical activity and lack of it and poor nutrition.
That's easily 10 years worth of work and more than that.
Very
sure.
Easily. But I cannot also put down our guard with basic preparedness and communicable disease, which includes preparing for hurricanes. We will always be a hurricane state. Public health has a huge part at that table in ensuring people's safety after big tropical storms as well.
For all the flooding in eastern North Carolina recently, I'm sure you were called in and to help prevent the outbreak of communicable diseases.
Correct. And we also have a major function in manning the shelters. So when people are evacuated to shelters, it's usually a public health nurse who is opening those doors and keeping people safe, sanitation, keeping that all up and running.
You mentioned about funding. And I just, before we leave, I know that there's been a challenge of the funding issues affecting not just public health, but across all of government in North Carolina, and budget cuts and necessary choices. And how do you figure out if you have to make cuts in programs that affect people? Because I know your programs affect people. How do you cope with this expanded role and yet this decline in available resources?
Right. Well, it's a tough call. We look at the span of life and where our dollars have the most impact. And if you look at a human life that should last to 80 years, we can probably make the most impact in the first three in terms of where we're really going to concentrate our dollars. That early brain development and getting that child ready to go to school is probably our biggest window of opportunity. These are also the most vulnerable people, are these small children and their families. So that's going to have a priority over an older age group when it comes down to those difficult choices. So we make it based on where we can most impact a population when we have limited dollars. Where is it going to go, and where's your window of opportunity to have the most impact?
Well, we do not envy you for having to make those choices and to do the hard work that you're doing. But we're so grateful that that you are being so thoughtful about it and leading the way for our state. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, we hope that the barrier that's always there from that falling over the cliff, that is the public health barrier that people maybe don't always know it's there, but is the resource that's behind there is better appreciated by your and your colleagues' work across the state, and maybe we can be more aware of that. So thanks again.
We've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Engel, North Carolina's state health director. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For House Calls segment of our show today, we're going to answer your questions, some experiences, what you have sent us, and hopefully you can send us your own questions and experiences.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read us some of the questions we have today. Julie?
My mother is 81 years old, and although she has seen her primary care doctor for 7 years, I think she should now see a doctor who specializes in geriatrics. What do you think?
That's a great question, and one that actually I get asked sometimes. Do you get asked that, Christy, sometimes?
I do sometimes. And I think it's good for you to consider that as she's getting older, that she does have special things to consider as it relates to aging. But I would argue if she's got a long-term relationship with a doctor, then that doctor is perhaps the specialist on your mom and perhaps the best doctor to be caring for her.
Yeah, you know, it really depends on lots of things that we don't know about your mother, the types of health problems she has and how she's doing. You know, sometimes when people think of this sort of question, their loved one is declining. And as they're declining, they're looking for answers to help reverse that decline and sometimes thinking, oh, well, maybe this doctor that they're going to is not really treating what needs to happen. And so those are all, again, great questions. But the answer may not be that the specialist will make it better.
And there are a lot of efforts to train both internal medicine doctors and family medicine doctors in the care of geriatric patients. It's essential for us because there are not enough geriatricians to care for all the people who are aging. But there are these people who have additional 1 year or so in caring for geriatric patients that might be used for consultation or may be appropriate in conjunction with the primary doctor.
Yeah, one thing that is good sometimes if you go see a specialist like who does more work in geriatrics is they may spend an hour and a half that your primary care doctor doesn't have time with and review every single medication, review all the preventive factors. One of the downsides that can occur is they may make lots of changes, and sometimes lots of changes in our loved ones as they get older. Sometimes if there's 2, 3, 4, 5 changes that occur at one visit, that can be too much and you may have more side effects and new medicines. So get a consultation if you want one. But maybe then talk, if you do, with your primary care doctor about which one of those things are reasonable to try. But I agree with Christy. Start with your primary care doctor and at least say what your concerns are.
Absolutely. Julie, what's next?
I recently had surgery on my leg, and afterwards I developed severe pain in my foot with swelling. It got so bad that I started taking oxycodone to get relief when nothing else would work. My primary care doctor suggested that I might be having a regional pain syndrome from the surgery, and he advised me to take two medicines called capsaicin and Neurontin for the pain. These helped a great deal, and I was able to lower the oxycodone. I had never heard of this regional pain syndrome before. How common is it?
Well, thank you for sharing your question. First off the bat, it sounds like your doctor probably addressed this, but when you have pain and swelling in one foot or leg after surgery, the first thing we think about is a blood clot. And that's very common after surgery and can be dangerous. So it's good that you went to see your doctor, and it sounds like he ruled that out.
And a regional pain syndrome is not a frequent occurrence after surgery, but yet it does occur, and one of the times it occurs is after trauma, if you fall, break an arm, or after surgery. And it sounds like in this particular case that the diagnosis could have been correct, particularly if medicines like capsaicin and Neurontin, which are two common medicines to treat a pain syndrome in the leg or the arm.
And it sounds like those worked for you, so that sort of indicates that it was along the right track, and we're glad that you're feeling better.
Yeah, capsaicin works by – it depletes the substance that's related from the nerve ending. So it wouldn't work if there probably wasn't something going on in the nerves, but you had to use it probably four times a day, and the Neurontin kind of dulls that nerve response pain. So again, these kind of bad things, if it was a clot, those things probably wouldn't have worked.
Right.
And we're so glad that you were able to get off oxycodone, which is a very potent narcotic that can have all kinds of side effects for healthy people as well as people after surgery.
So hopefully that helps a little bit, and we're glad you're better. Julie, what's next?
I am an older person who recently started having a tremor in my hand when I start to pick up my fork. I'm shaking a fair amount. A friend suggested it was Parkinson's disease. I hope not. Should I see a neurologist?
Another really great question, and a tricky one, and a scary one when you have a tremor like that.
Yeah. You know, at any age, I think if you're starting to have a shaking hand when you're trying to pick up something, it's scary because it makes you think of all kinds of neurological diseases, many of which, like Parkinson's, aren't great for people, and they're associated with more severe types of medical problems. But in your case, there are maybe some other things that we would consider that maybe indicate that this is not indeed Parkinson's.
We also want to think about any medications you're on that could contribute to a tremor. There are certain psychiatric or mental health medications that can cause you to have a little bit of a tremor. But the more common thing is something called benign essential tremor, or something called an intention tremor.
Yeah, and this is what it sounds like you might have. When you intend to do something, when you're reaching out for something, that the hand starts shaking. And it does happen as we get older. It tends to have a genetic basis. You might have had a parent that had it. And it is unlike Parkinson's, which is a tremor that tends to be there at rest, but it gets better. I'm not sure you should see your neurologist, but I do know that you should see your primary care physician and talk with them about this and let them do a good physical exam on you. And what else might they do if it were an intention tremor?
Well, they would examine you and watch the tremor, have you do exercises with your hand where you have to reach out and touch something to observe whether it's happening more with movement.
And even if it gets more severe, there are some medications that sometimes can treat. Sometimes they'll have patients take something called a beta blocker.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do this lightly because it has side effects. But again, this hopefully should not get a lot worse, and hopefully there's nothing else associated with it. Thank you so much for that question. What's our very last house call today, Julie?
My daughter is 13 years old and heavy. Obesity, diabetes, and blood pressure problems run in our family, and all the teenage kids in our entire extended family are heavy. It's just in our blood, I guess, and although I try to pay attention to my daughter's diet, she seems to be getting heavier and heavier. At her last physical, her doctor said she was worried about her blood pressure being high, which really scares me. I want her to exercise, but now I'm worried about her health. Do you have any recommendations for me as a mother? What should I do?
Wow. Well, first of all, you are doing the right thing as a mother by taking your child in, by paying attention to this, and by really using that blood pressure as a wake-up call for the importance of making some changes.
Yeah, and I applaud you for, as a mother, for the concern you're showing for your child, and hopefully bringing your father in or other elements of the family, because this is a family issue. It affects everyone in the family. It's affecting you, your daughter, maybe some siblings here. And yes, there's some genetic elements here. She may even have what's called the metabolic syndrome, where it's not only the weight, but it is the blood pressure and the risk factor for diabetes, just as you mentioned. So we want to really prevent these things really from getting to be a problem.
And unfortunately, this is very common with the obesity epidemic among teenagers. And high blood pressure among teenagers is increasingly common. When we look for it, we find it, and it is strongly related to the weight. So the first line of change is really in, as you're saying, Adam, bringing the whole family together for family lifestyle change. And that can include exercising together, changing your grocery shopping habits, changing what's available with the meals as well.
Yeah. The simple fact is, unfortunately, the change is going to require reduction in intake. Reducing the amount of intake. Whatever intake you think that your daughter has, it's going to have to be less than what it is now in order for her to lose weight. You're going to need help with that, with your physician, with a nutritionist, with greater support.
And for most people, exercise is still indicated. It's important. So talk with your doctor about that.
Well, Christy, we've had a chance to talk about geriatric issues and regional pain syndromes.
About obesity and blood pressure. And about tremor.
Yeah. Well, that'll conclude House Calls today. And thank you for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us your own issues at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 966-8081. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
And you can follow us on Twitter. We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Engel. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.